Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 27th of January 2013. My name is T.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers, Nick from Partially Obstructed View, Web Cowgirl, and Ref Stan. We're now going to talk about Old Times, which has just opened at the Harold Pinter Theatre, formerly the Comedy Theatre. This is a play by Harold Pinter, written for Peter Hall's 40th birthday, apparently, in 1971. And for me, it's always been a little bit mysterious. We have a husband and wife who are expecting the visit, a visit from one of the wife, Kate's, oldest friends. This is Anna. The husband's called Dealey. The idea here is that it's about jealousy and sexual tension and memory and history and the way they fabricate things. In this production, directed by Henriksen, we've got Rufus Sewell as Dealey, and Kristen Scott Thomas and Leah Williams are alternating the parts of Kate and Anna. It's a rather interesting way of doing it, although I'm not sure that everybody could afford to, you know, go and see both because of the West End ticket prices at the moment. Generally, I like this. I like this play. I saw it ages ago. First saw it ages ago with Lee Lawson, Harriet Walter and Julie Christie were in it when I saw it in the West End. And more recently, in 2004, the Dunmar Warehouse did a strikingly designed one where they were in a glass box, which starred Jeremy Northam, Gina McKee and Helen McCrory. What I always liked about this play was the kind of idea that you're not really in the real world. It's a sort of in an imagined space, and I think that's what I had a problem with this production, that they tried to make it real. There were lots of touches of sort of domestic and real. You got the sense that they were, a lot of the times that they were trying, the director or the actors were trying to make these people sort of very real and very realistic and naturalistic, and I thought that fought against the text and fought against the play itself. But I mean, that's my thought. I mean, generally, this is a very good production. I think it's got it's very well acted. It's done in, I think, period. It's about 19. It looks vaguely 70s. So they're sticking to that. But I was slightly disappointed by this. Although I don't think everybody else was. And they were, you know, it's a good night. Generally, a good night out at the theatre. Phil, what did you think about it?
I really enjoyed it. I saw the Julie Christie production, which I can't remember anything about the story, such as it is, apart from it being Julie Christie and how good she looked. In this, I found I don't know which way around you saw it. I know we did talk about it the other night, but I saw it with Kristen Scott Thomas playing Anna, who's the friend, who's sort of the slightly more glamorous one, and Leah Williams is sort of the slightly dowdier, more sort of put-upon friend from the past. For me, that seemed the logical way with Kristen Scott Thomas playing that part, which is a bigger part, and she's got more words, apart from the speech at the end, which Leah Williams delivered. Because Kristen Scott Thomas is the more obviously glamorous. But I found that also slightly distracting because there were times when I was thinking, well, I wonder what it's like the other way around. How different would it be? But that aside, I thought what they did do very well apart from just generally the acting was excellent, was the comedy in it. It made me laugh quite a lot in the way that they delivered it. And particularly Rufus Sewell, who had this sort of twinkle in his eye the whole time, but sometimes the twinkle looked quite sinister, which was sort of very Pinteresque, but it really worked for me. And that keep changing, his personality kept sort of changing from this very charismatic, sort of slightly grinning kind of figure to where the grin became quite menacing. I think it was about sort of how we reconstruct our memories from the past and the fact that we can't really trust our memories because they do have this almost tag game with Kate at the beginning where they're sort of talking about the past and she keeps complaining that they're talking about her like she's not there. But that's quite interesting because at the very beginning we see a scene between Dealey and his wife, Kate, and I think Anna's probably not meant to be there because they're talking about her, but she's actually standing at the window and it's a scene and she's actually already in the room with them. So I don't know if it's normally done like that. I can't remember, But I thought that was quite an interesting take on it. I didn't mind the fact that the set, I think the set wasn't really that realistic. It's a very bare sort of room. And when it changes for the scene change, it's just basically a colour change of the walls and the sofas become beds. It felt very like it could be anywhere. There's not really much clues apart from perhaps period and the fact that it feels a bit remote, although they do talk about other people who seem to be nearby. No, I found it fascinating and quite entertaining, and it's also very short. It's 80 minutes long. It's not the advertised 90 minutes. It rips through it in 80 minutes, which was very satisfying, and it was just about the right length and excellently played, I thought.
Nick, what did you think?
I saw it the same way around as Tim did. I saw it with Kristen Scott Thomas's Kate. Also, I haven't seen this particular Pinter before, so I would agree with Phil that it's that I didn't find actually this. I think it's probably the case of maybe you having seen a very very stylized set for it. I didn't think the set was particularly naturalistic. I found it actually quite, it felt kind of very heavily symbolic. Certainly the bedroom set felt very kind of womb-like sort of red space. I quite enjoyed it. I this was one of those that I enjoyed more afterwards. It's kind of, I found it in some ways even more kind of oblique while you're watching it than Pinter usually is. But actually, thinking about it for like the trip home, it suddenly kind of clicked what I think was happening, which I won't say here because obviously spoilers. But and I sort of put together a theory of actually what was going on, and it's one of those that's quite satisfying, I think, to put together things of how things might fit into that theory, like the thing of Anna being in the room but not in the room, and the opposite as well of talking about Kate as if she's not there, which all fit into what I think it was really going on in there. So yeah, I found that, yes, I really liked the performances. I'm quite glad I saw it that way around, simply from having seen now some publicity photos of it both ways around, and thinking I would be incredibly distracted by the wigs the other way around. They just don't look very natural. But
to me,
yeah,
well, yeah, they looked. I was trying to see a wig line on it.
I mean, it was after I'd seen it, and I saw the pictures, and it looked right. You know, it looked right to be with Kristen Scott Thomas with the brown hair, and Liam Williams with the blonde. Seeing the photos of it the other way around, kind of was like, oh, that doesn't look right. But it may just be because I'd just seen it. Yeah, no, I did like it. I found it one of the it. I agree, it's got quite nicely, it picks out the humour quite nicely. Possibly not quite to the extent that some of the audience seem to think on the night, but I think sometimes with West End stuff and with star casting, you do get kind of people who aren't necessarily familiar with what they're going to get, and if that happens to be Pinter, it can quite throw them, and they don't know how to react to it the first couple of times you see him. I certainly came quite late to Pinter, and I've really grown to love his work, but it is quite daunting when you first start seeing his work, because there's certainly nothing, he certainly spells nothing out for you, which once you kind of get into the mindset of it, I find very rewarding. And like I say, particularly with this one kind of going, oh my God, I see what I think is going on, and trying to put it together as a puzzle, I quite enjoy that, and it's one of the more overtly puzzle like ones that he's that I've seen that he's written. So yes, it'll be interesting to see how it does. I think it'll probably get by on the star casting, really, but it'll be interesting to see how people respond to it, because you do get Pinters in the West End, and obviously there's a particular reason that theatre was named after him, because it always had a history of staging his work, even though this is the first one since it got renamed. But I think I've usually seen, you know, the more straightforward ones in the West End, and some of the more obscure ones kind of in smaller venues or more kind of subsidised venues. So it'll be interesting to see how people respond to it. But I certainly enjoyed it.
It wasn't so much my problem that I had a problem with the set. It was the problem was certain domestic touches in the acting.
Yeah.
Her concern, you know, things like Kate's concern over her husband's drinking. And I thought that took me away from the... Because it is supposed to be... I think it is supposed to be mysterious. You're not entirely... You know, you're not in reality. And they kept... For me, it kept doing things which kind of grounded in reality and naturalism, right, which I really didn't want. Because, yeah, like you say, there's lots of different interpretations of it. And you just... You, it's what I find fun in the play is living with a mystery. Sorry, Phil, I interrupted you.
No, I was just going to say about... I think they've got two sort of press nights for critics, so they'll see it both ways around if they've got time, which it'd be interesting to see which way around they prefer it. I mean, I did look it up on Wikipedia to see what it was all about. It was all various interpretations. One is apparently that Kate and Anna are different personalities of the same person, which actually would understand why they're switching the roles on different nights.
That is, I mean, I think that's where we were having the conversation. I think that's where it started me off, because that is the interpretation I came up with. And I think that's what started us off, because we came out of it thinking, you know what, I think the fact that it's alternating is, I think, is a deliberate reference to the characters and something about the characters.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what got us into that, that they are interchangeable for a reason.
Yeah. It's funny enough, because there's a bit of me that actually now wants to see it the other way around, which is quite strange, because at first I thought, oh, that's a bit of a gimmick, but although those gimmicks have been done before with Frankenstein and Olivier and Gilbert used to switch roles, didn't they, in Romeo and Juliet, I think, and possibly other things, I'm not sure. So it's not a new thing, but I can sort of see why, for this, they're doing it now, although, of course, most audiences will only see one, so from an audience's point of view, it's a little bit redundant. Apart from perhaps huge fans of Pinter who will go and see both.
Or huge fans of one of the actresses.
Oh, yeah, that's true, yeah. I mean, the stalls were packed when I saw it yesterday afternoon.
Yeah.
We're now going to talk about Turn of the Screw, which is a new play on at the Almeida. This is Rebecca Linkowitz's adaptation of the Henry James novella. And it's directed by Lindsay Posner, and perhaps we should also mention Scott Penrose, who's the illusionist in this, which gives us a quite... because this is a ghost story, and is quite a... so we get quite a lot of sort of appearances and things writing on blackboards and stuff like that, so it's probably worth mentioning him. But there's a very nice, I thought, very nice stage design. We have a rotating stage design. It's rather ambitious, really, at the Almeida. But the design's by Peter McIntosh. That was actually one of the more impressive things about this play. This play is about a young governess who is tasked with looking after two children in a big country house. I think it's in Essex. She's told that she must not involve the master, the sort of the guardian of these children in anything. She has to take complete control. She arrives there and discovers that they both appear to be haunted by the previous governor and the steward, I think he was, of the household, Peter Quint. They're haunted by the memories of them. We're told by the housekeeper that the old governess and Peter Quint were explicit in their love for each other and were involving the children in some way. We're not entirely certain. It's not entirely certain what they do, and the governess begins to see these people, and we see them, and she is she reacts badly to it, and she involves herself involves the children in trying to get them to admit that they also see these ghosts of these two people who've died sort of somewhat violently or somewhat terribly in the recent past. And she really makes a complete mess of it. That's essentially the story. It's not a story I particularly have ever liked. I've seen quite a few film. This has been done quite a few times on film. There's an opera of it, and I think I saw a touring production of it a couple of years ago. And it's not something I really like as a story anyway. But I have to say that this production, although we've got excellent people like Anna Madley and Gemma Jones as the governess and the housekeeper, Mrs. Grouse, although they're very good, I did find the script, certainly to begin with, it was very, very clomping, I think is the word I thought of at the time. It's just, I don't know, mechanical and heavy and rather dull. It gets a lot better. Certainly towards the interval and after the interval, we start getting a lot of scares, a lot of very good effects in this play, it's in the end it is rather impressive, but I still have reservations about the script and of course reservations about the story. But then you know if you don't particularly like a story, it's not exactly gonna. This didn't help me like this story any more than I do already. Nick, what did you think about it?
I'm also somebody who's I have read the novella and I'm not a huge fan of it. It's one of those stories that I can see how it influenced many things coming after it, but I'm slightly confused as to why it itself is still loved and enjoyed in the way that it is, because it feels like it kind of does it feels like it kind of provides a blueprint for these kind of Victorian ghost stories that are still, you know, that lead up all the way to things like The Woman in Black about 100 years after this was first written, that, you know, I can see how it's influential, but the way the story itself is constructed and told, yeah, I'm confused as to why it's still loved to the extent it is. So, yes, for me as well, that is an issue. I kind of felt like I wished Rebecca Linkevich had been a bit... There's little things that she kind of not changes exactly, but she puts the sexuality of it a lot more in the foreground. It's a lot less subtle, and there is a change in I can't remember, but I've in the story the older boy is 10 years old, and here obviously he's quite a lot older. He's played by Lawrence Belcher here, who has to be 16 at least, because he's not alternating the role. So, and certainly in the way the story's told, his kind of adolescent sexuality and even the governess's kind of repressed Victorian sexuality heavily hinted to be kind of connected to what's going on. Unfortunately, it's not kind of linked in quite to the extent that it's there, but it's I would have liked if she'd been a bit more daring with maybe even the story, maybe even diverging a bit from what happens in the story, because I think it's I find that the actual story a bit underwhelming. It's kind of we think this is going on and that does go on, you know, there's no real surprises to it. I suppose this is the sort of thing that if I gave stars out, it'd be like a 3-star show. It's perfectly all right, but I didn't think the scares particularly worked. There's a lot of kind of the tension not really working right. I agree about the set. It was a lovely set, Peter McIntosh, but I kind of felt like the cleverness of it and the tricks of it were kind of wasted, because everything took so long to actually get to the kind of the surprise. There's a certain amount of time that you can sit there and look and see that there's a window and that it's lit in a certain way, and you maybe don't know when that particular scare is going to come, but you know it's going to come. And yeah, I felt like invariably this missed kind of its opportunity for every single scare. It kind of came a little bit too late, a little bit kind of wrong. There was certainly not, there's the old bit of gasping in the audience, but not a lot of kind of scared reactions like you get in other kind of ghost shows that have been on in recent years. I thought it was a really good cast. I thought, I mean, Gemma Jones is always good to see, but it felt a bit of a waste here, because it's not a very exciting part for her. The two younger actors are very good, and they have a hell of a lot to do in the show. On the night I went, the girl was Lucy Morton. She's alternating with two other girls. And I just felt it was fine. It was kind of fun and entertaining enough, but it was just that little bit underwhelming, and it kind of fell that little bit flat.
Phil, what did you think?
Well, I think what it set out to do was to try and be the new Woman in Black. It was going for the shocks and the moments where the audience jumped, which the night I went, they certainly did. In the first act, there was a couple of moments where the audience, a few people actually screamed, and then, of course, you get the laughter afterwards. It amused me. And in the second act, I jumped hugely at one point, which we can't reveal what it was, so that worked for me. It really was, I think, aiming to be a piece of entertainment. It's not, I mean, it's so long since I saw The Woman in Black, but I do remember being quite spooked by that. I thought it had a quite good atmosphere of spookiness. I agree with you about the design, and I think even just looking at the design with the stage revolve and the sort of the multiple interiors and exteriors of the estate that we see, it's, and the special effects, it's really looking to go beyond the Almeida, possibly a tour, or possibly even the West End, I would have thought, because it's co-produced by Hammer House of Theatre, who actually, I think, was a connection with the guy that did The Woman in Black anyway. Yeah, it sort of does slightly creak and plod at times, and I think all that could be tightened up a little bit, but this was a preview that I saw. And I think really one of the big mistakes is having an interval. It's 2 hours, 10 minutes. If you got rid of the interval, it'd be 1 hour, 50 minutes straight through, and I think it really would perhaps ratchet up the tension. I think that's what it's aiming to do. I can understand why they've got an older boy playing, is it Miles? Because obviously the scenes of sort of sexuality are fairly overt for a young child to do, so he's got to be of an age to do that. And I think I saw Lucy Morton too the night I went, and both of them I thought were very good in the part.
I certainly agree about the interval. I mean, we got to that and just went, right, now? You've done all that, you've just got the tension going, and now you're going to stop it?
So go straight through. It would be it'd be much better, and maybe trim another 5 minutes off somewhere. I mean, the opening scene, I think, where she's meeting the uncle of the children, I thought was quite a good scene setting. You can hear the ticking clock. It's quite slow, but I think deliberately slow. And then it was quite a surprise. I could see that it was going to revolve, but it was quite a surprise the way the set sort of opened up into this estate. It looked quite lavish, and I think I'm sure they're looking to take it somewhere else.
I wonder if that's maybe why it has an interval, because it's certainly not the Almeida don't have one of these, you know, they don't have a policy against not having an interval. Because I know a lot of places, because of the bar, they get forced to have an interval whether it suits or not.
Mm.
So maybe if they're looking to take it elsewhere, they have to fit an interval in. But it's certainly not them, because I know they have done shows there without intervals fairly regularly.
Yeah, that's why I was surprised. And again, that might suggest that they're looking to do a transfer. But I think the interval is a big mistake, because if they want it to be a hit with audiences, people who like this sort of thing, and I quite like seeing special effects, especially when well done, which they were on the whole. And, you know, the fact it did make me jump, I just didn't see one of the surprises coming. I can't really ask for more than that. It spooked me enough that I jumped in my seat, as I was meant to do.
We're now going to talk about Fair M, which is on at the Union Theatre. This is one of those Shakespeare apocrypha plays. This is actually done by Phil Wilmot as director, who produced Double Falsehood at the Union a year or so ago, and it's probably not Shakespeare. Having seen it, it's a rather slight tale about. Oddly enough, it starts off with William the Conqueror, who's described sometimes as a Saxon duke, and it goes off to woo the daughter of the King of Denmark. Then there's the subplot, which is we're not entirely sure if it's a subplot or a main plot, about Fair M, who is pursued by three young gentlemen, but her father is in hiding and has disguised himself as a miller, so she appears to all intents and purposes to be a miller's daughter, and she's in love with one of the young swains who's after her, but she has to pretend to be deaf and blind in order to prevent to sort of get their interest, to stop the interest of the other two.
Okay, we should just stop telling the plot.
but
just gets more convoluted with every word that comes out of your mouth.
Yeah, okay. So, but I think the thing about this is, although it sounds convoluted, it's actually a very slight piece, I thought. I, you know, I, there's no, there's no great psychological depth to it. It's very much like, I don't know. It felt a bit like a medieval mystery play, or you know that kind of approach to it, approach to playing. It felt slightly Canterbury Tales-ish. The most disappointing thing I think the night I went was that. The cast outnumbered us in the audience, which was tragic. I mean, it is a fairly big cast, but it was a disappointing feeling because the cast worked quite well, and I think actually this production's it gives it almost its best chance because it's not a fantastic play. It's as I say, very slight and a bit silly. Now, Web Cowgirl, what did you think about it?
Well, I was fortunate enough to go on a night when the house was quite full. So I suspect of people who were actually very curious to see a play that I think hadn't been produced in an extremely long time. And I hadn't read it. I hadn't read the publicity material very well, but it's pretty clear that this is absolutely not Shakespeare, and they don't really think it's Shakespeare at all. It just happened to be in a folder of stuff that said, you know, plays by Shakespeare, but it's never been in the traditional collection. And I did, of course, because the word Shakespeare is mentioned so many times, go hoping to see a show that was, you know, if perhaps convoluted, at least contained, you know, the sort of buds of genius that you'll see if you go to see, you know, like early Tennessee Williams, where you can see that his voice is coming through. But of course, this isn't by Shakespeare, so there isn't any voice to come through. My take on this play wasn't so much that it was like a passion play, but it was more, well, not a mystery play. It was more the equivalent of Elizabethan, sort of like the movies we watch today, like Dumb and Dumber, that never come up for the Academy Awards, but everybody still will come and see them. It's just like what the person on the street might enjoy popping in to see for a little bit of fun after a hard week making barrels or, mending fishnets. But it wasn't a play for the intelligentsia. It wasn't written by anyone who was a genius. That it was a bit of entertainment. It was actually fairly light, and I don't think its creator ever intended it to be, you know, sort of the theatrical equivalent of the Academy Award winner for Best Picture of, well, I don't know what, 1540 or whatever. That it was just
it's straight to DVD, isn't it? That's what it is. It's a
straight to DVD. And I, on the other hand, I have to say that while the script was killing me with its ludicrousness, I was actually enjoying watching the actors make a good go of it. And, you know, actually the costuming for what should have been, you'd imagine, such a low-budget production, given that the Union usually, none of the shows that happen there tend to have like really big budgets, so they really seem to go for it. And so I do think that, you know, this was probably the best production that you could get out of this play. But really, it would have normally been straight to DVD, and I don't usually go see plays of that quality. Nick?
I mean, one thing I certainly agree about is that the production makes a rod for its own back with the Shakespeare references all over the publicity. And it tries to kind of have its cake and eat it, because it kind of goes, you know, it kind of Shakespeare, definitely not Shakespeare, but hey, let's debate whether it's Shakespeare. Well, there isn't actually any debate. I mean, it's, you know, there's Double Falsehood has some kind of debate behind it. It has some controversy behind it. You know, like you say, they are simply somebody filed a load of plays under the wrong name, and nobody has ever particularly, there's never been any real debate that Shakespeare had anything to do with it. So it kind of, you know, where kind of Double Falsehood, when you see that, it does kind of, you do kind of try to sit there going, oh, you know, that bit could be, you know, it's like, well, it's clearly not as an entire play, but oh, there's little hints of it. This is very different from that. It's clearly not. There's clearly a reason why it hasn't been produced for so long. I thought that there were some good actors in it. I thought the two leading ladies came off particularly well. And there's a lot of actors who I've seen kind of perform well in other things who I thought were a bit disappointing in this. And I think it was a lot to do with the style of it. I think what's kind of happened is, again, kind of past the idea of, you know, let's try and revive something incredibly obscure and see if we have a hit like we did a couple of years ago. I think, you know, at some point it's kind of become aware that actually the play they've chosen is a bit of a dud. And I think they've gone for quite a big performance style that is, at times it felt to me like Panto without the jokes. You know, that's kind of what it felt like to me. And, so I just, it's not something I can get to, you know, it's one of those things you just can't muster up either any enthusiasm or any real kind of anger about. It's just kind of there. It's just disappointing. And I'm not particularly surprised. When I saw it, it was about probably a little over half full, but I'm not surprised if it's not really been getting the word of mouth to fill it up in its kind of later part of the run, because it's there's nothing really that you're missing if you miss it.
You know, I wish that this kind of effort could have been put into maybe another contemporary comedy, because we get a lot, you know, piles of Shakespeare, and then, you know, we've got the revenge tragedies. But I like to think that, you know, there has to be some contemporaneous comedies not by Shakespeare out there. And I think that this, if it had been a better written play, that with this kind of full-out effort to make the most of it, that they could have had like a pretty damn good show. But I think this one, that when they opened the folio and they saw the play, that they should have just gently slipped it back in and maybe looked and see what was in the rest of it.
I think this is the thing. I think the play has been chosen because it's easier to publicise, because it's got an entirely tenuous Shakespeare connection, because you can stick the name in there even as you then immediately retract it and say it's definitely not him. You've still got it on there and giving people the curiosity. I mean, what I was surprised at is that it's... Because Double Falsehood was 2 years ago, and what he did, Phil Wilmot, last year was he did King John. I mean, funnily enough, that resulted in me having two King Johns in a year, and I mean, when does that happen? But it's, it seems like if that was, you know, he's had a hit with obscure Shakespeares or dubious Shakespeares, you'd think, well, there's still actually plenty of Shakespeares that very rarely get produced, probably even less so than King John. I mean, I still haven't seen a production of Two Noble Kinsmen, and I mean, I've only ever once seen The Two Gentlemen of Verona, so there's plenty of plays out there that are Shakespeare and are obscure. And yeah, on top of that, as you say, there's the lesser known but quite respectable, decent kind of plays. And I think it's a shame that this one got... I mean, the Shakespeare connection even goes down to the set. I was looking at it, and it's the action is entirely either in Denmark or in rural England, and the set, the backdrop is Elizabethan London with the globe in prominent position. So, you know, it really makes a rod for its own back and has no chance of living up to the promise it gives you by sticking Shakespeare's name all over it.
Yeah, I definitely feel that the we need to produce more of Shakespeare's contemporaries' works. The RSC some years ago, well, must be about 10 years ago now, did a season of plays of Shakespeare's contemporaries and really made a good fist of it. I mean, you got introduced some really great playwrights like John Marston, who I'd never heard of before I saw the Shakespeare season, and he seemed to produce some really great plays. I think one of his plays was The Roman Actor, which was fantastic, and another one called The Malcontent was really good. I mean, this play has, yeah, no psychological input. What I meant by the mystery plays is that mystery plays were sort of done by amateur companies, and they were full of sort of silly jokes, and they were done, you know, they were a bit like the medieval equivalent of Panto, as you said. It has that sort of the Panto element and the very simple story. I mean, it is a bit like something from the Decameron or from the Canterbury Tales in the way it tells it. It's also massively historically inaccurate. I mean, even it's you know, I know his Shakespeare's not particularly historically accurate, but this is way out there. It's completely wrong in so many ways. But
Tim, I could totally imagine the cast suddenly stopping and then breaking out in Gangnam Style. It would have been perfect, but we couldn't have any jokes because it wasn't actually a panto. Any jokes besides the woman pretending to be deaf and then pretending to be blind and then trying to pretend to be both at the same time? Oh my God. It was just really one of the worst scripts I have ever seen put on a stage in my life.
I mean, actually, with what you were just saying about the RSC, I don't know if you've seen, and I don't know whether you, I mean, I do far too often go out to Stratford-upon-Avon as well, but that has been one thing that Gregory Doran has said, is that he's going to rededicate the Swan to exactly that, to the contemporaries. He's going to keep the Shakespeare in the main house and rededicate the Swan to other writers of the period, which apparently is what it was originally intended to be. That's not actually something he's doing in his opening season, but he has said that's what he wants to do with it.
Cool.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it is one of those things I'm rather have a bit of a bee in my bonnet about, because I think that if we did the Shakespeare's contemporaries to the same extent that we did do Shakespeare, then we would see, you know, we would be able to put Shakespeare in context, because a lot of people sort of, you know, act as if he is this great, you know, that he is absolutely peerless. But quite a lot of his contemporaries, at their best, were, you know, certainly not as good as Shakespeare at his best, but certainly better than one or two of Shakespeare's more obscure and more difficult plays, or the ones that we don't perform quite so much, because he had a lot of good people around him, and I think we tend to forget that, you know, because of this sort of overwhelming Shakespeare worship, which I, you know, obviously I worship Shakespeare like any sensible person, but there you go.
Well, on the flip side as well, you kind of understand what his why he's kind of become more set out from the crowd. If you know what the crowd is, you know, you know why he's what is particularly better about him as an overall canon. I agree, there are certain minor plays in the canon that you can then find, you know, other writers that have written better things than that. But, you know, it's kind of the flip side, is you kind of see what other people have put together, and you see why maybe Shakespeare had the edge that has brought him into that position in the first place.
That sounds kind of exciting, actually. I'm sorry I missed that season at the RSC, but, you know, I guess maybe I'll have another chance, huh?
We're now going to talk about Quatermain's Terms, which is just previewing at the Wyndham Theatre in London. This is something of a straight play comeback for Rowan Atkinson. He was in Oliver a few years back, but he hasn't really done a normal straight play for a considerable number of years now. And this play by Simon Gray is something of a comeback, and perhaps a little bit disappointing. We'll see why. He's joined by two exceptionally good stage performers in Conleth Hill and Will Keane, and also we have Felicity Montague, Malcolm Sinclair, Matthew Cottle, and Louise Ford in the play. So it ought to be good. I'm fairly fond of Simon Gray as a writer, and this is, well, it's he writes okay plays. I don't think that this is a great play by any stretch of imagination, but I found the play all right. The problem I had with it really was that Rowan Atkinson, the man they're selling this entire play on, spends all his time sitting in a chair, and it's not good. Or spends most of his time sitting in a chair anyway, and it's not the best use of his talents. He's rather quiet, rather gentle character. The idea of this is it's set in the staff room as a foreign language college in Cambridge in the 1960s, and it's sort of about the lives of the various teachers within it. You have St. John Quatermain, played by Rowan Atkinson, as a sort of single bachelor and sort of a genuinely nice guy. He's just nice single man, getting on in years, a bit dozy, would rather be sleeping in his chair during the day than actually teaching students anything. And he's not really good at his job, but he's sort of kept on because he's been there forever. then there's others. Malcolm Sinclair is the sort of co-head of the school, constantly at the beck and call of an unseen, his unseen friend. It's this play, I think, was written in 1981. So we're looking at this is probably a gay relationship, although it's not spelled out explicitly, but it is kind of suggested. We also have Conleth Hill, as I said, as a sort of avuncular, rather married. And rather skillful teacher, very, very well rounded and very grounded, and with lots of problems of his family. This is one of the things: is a Quatermain gets involved with all these people off stage, and we hear about his adventures, and it goes over about 3 years altogether, the play, and it goes from them sort of not wanting to him to them appreciating him, and once they all sort of appreciate him, that's kind of where the play ends, and there's a sort of fairly final bit to it, which I won't spoil, but it's that sort of growth. I mean, him going from being lazy to being sort of wanted, and perhaps within this staff room. I found it a sort of an efficient play, but I don't think it's a great play, and it's not a star vehicle, especially not for the person playing Quatermain. One or two people were muttering darkly that they were being a bit ripped off. This is a play where the cheapest tickets are the best part of £30, and I think a lot of people are going to go away from this play disappointed. I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with the production. Rowan Atkinson is fine. He doesn't project quite as well as, say, someone like Conleth Hill. But Conleth Hill's one of the best stage actors in the country. So he's not going to look as good as somebody as experienced as Conleth Hill. But I thought he was perfectly good. But I don't think this is the play for him. I don't think he's quite right for Quatermain. That you might want to say about, which of his familiar characters he might be like, but yes, it was a little bit disappointing, but not a bad thing. But I think it's not going to get. I don't think the crowds are going to come back to it on words of mouth. What do you think about it, Rev Stan?
Well, first of all, it's Simon Gray's writing is very, very subtle, and it's what I like to call a dramedy. It's essentially a drama, but with a bit of comedy thrown in, and there is something. It is quite depressing, and something quite tragic about it. But it's all very, very British, and my two problems with it. First of all, is that sort of very Britishness about it. The comedy was very British. Kind of felt like I'd seen it all before. And I know it's sort of, it's a play that's 30 years old now, but it feels like so much has been done that's better. When a humour is about someone ripping their trousers and being too polite to sort of like just desperately trying to cover it up without actually just saying, look, and someone just get me a safety pin, or I've had this accident, or there's a scene where Quatermain finally gets an invite from somebody and ends up getting three invites for the same night and is too polite to turn any of them down. And it's just like, it's been done so much before, it's just not funny. I didn't find it funny. The second problem I had with it, you sort of alluded to about Rowan Atkinson coming back to the stage. I was really, really looking forward to seeing him on stage. I hate with a passion Mr. Bean, but I know that he's an actor that's got far greater range than sort of the characters he seems to have fallen into in recent years. And I was really thought that this would be a vehicle that he was going to do something different, some moving away. But for me, there was just too much of, yes, he sat in the chair a lot, but there was that sort of like the rubber faced sort of smile and the licking of the lips, the sort of just a few of the too many mannerisms of Mr. Bean that just sort of disappointed me, really, because I was expecting something very, very different. And I think you're right in saying I don't think this was quite the right vehicle for him to sort of make his big stage comeback. I didn't see him as Fagin in Oliver, so I don't know what his performance was like in that. But this, I was disappointed because it wasn't what I was expecting, and I would like to see him do something that was completely straight and just to showcase his talents a bit more, because I think he's far more talented than what was on display here. That's not to say that I didn't enjoy, you know, I enjoy bits of Quatermain. I mean, there are some great moments in it. There's a brilliant flirtation scene, you know, a very British flirtation scene, albeit, but, and there's some one or two lovely laugh out loud moments. And there was one particular moment when I did really feel for Rowan Atkinson's character, and you did sort of feel the sort of tragedy of his character. You know, he's just desperately wants friends and wants to be accepted, and people generally just use him as babysitters, and you know, when there's no one else they can turn to. And so there was one particular moment when I did feel sorry for him, but it was just one moment, and I don't think the sum of all the parts adds up to a particularly brilliant night out at the theatre, I'm afraid.
I've seen Rowan Atkinson before on stage. I mean, years and years ago, getting on for 30 years ago, I think it is, in a play called The Nerd, with a young actor called Christian Bale, was also in the cast, and that was madcap, much more madcap, and that was actually very, very Mr. Bean. It was actually, I think, before he invented the character of Mr. Bean. He was quite appalling person, and they told a joke in that which I laughed about inadvertently for a considerable length of time afterwards. I can't really repeat it. It's a bit vulgar, but that was a very memorable performance, and you know, truly Bean like in the way it's done it. But I think the rest of us want to see we want to see Blackadder, don't we? Perhaps. I mean, I'd love to see him do a role like that, you know, where he's commanding, you know, where he's commanding, but it's all a mess. I much prefer that to this sort of gentle, you know, it's a very gentle part, it's a very gentle role, and, it's just not good enough, really.
I think I would agree with you. Yes, I want to see him do something like Blackadder, or just play straight and, as you say, commanding. Just different, because he just plays these bumbling idiots all the time, and it's just he's got more talent than that, I think. The very first time I saw him was actually doing his stand-up show back when I was a teenager in the 80s, and you know, he was great. He was absolutely fantastic, and he is a very, very talented actor and performer.
Yeah, I still have the tapes of his live show, and I saw one of the two big ones that he did, and he's amazing. I mean, the thing is, the only thing I hope is that it doesn't get mauled too badly, and he wants to come back and do something else, and somebody finds a more suitable vehicle, because you know, it would be worthwhile. I mean, you know, he's always someone you're going to look out for, but I think this is a misfire, and I'm not sure that I did notice one or two empty seats after the interval, but it was I couldn't see most of the audience, and I'm just wondering if it's going to get bad word of mouth. I think it'll get decent reviews, but I don't think it'll get good word of mouth. You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are ayu-londontheatre.org, and the podcast can also be found both on iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.